My name is Mark Schwain, and I teach at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. And I'm on teaching staff this week and next, and helping a little bit, or was helping a little bit, my wife Dorothy Bass, who's the summer teaching staff coordinator, last week while she was attending board meetings. This week I'm offering a series of sessions on the life and work of Norman McLean, and this is the third of four of those. We began with a session entitled just that, where I gave some biographical background on his work that had direct bearing on his work. And we did a little bit of study even in that session of a couple of scenes from River Runs Through It. And then yesterday was kind of River Runs Through It day, because there was a session on it in the afternoon, and then in the evening, I know many of you came right to this room and watched the film, and many of you pressed me today, would I please permit at least a few questions in this session on the film, since people seemed tired and we didn't really have a question-answer session then, so I'll allow a little time here to talk about something or other that you might want to discuss about the film before moving on. This session is on Young Men in Fire, and then tomorrow's is called The Theology of Norman McLean, The Stakes of Stories, I've entitled it, which will go in even further depth into his work, focusing again on those two books. So before turning to Young Men in Fire, are there any questions? A couple of you had a few questions even before we started that you'd like to take up from the film that you saw last evening.
You know, it's not a question, but it's just a comment that, you know, I've seen that film so many times, and it's one of my favorite films, but I wanted to thank you so much for your discussion of it, because last night seeing it, I just had a much deeper understanding of the film, looking at it from that viewpoint that you were suggesting, that idea of how can we help, and mm-hmm. that whole issue of helping. And it just made it so much deeper for me.
Well, good.
Yeah,
thank you.
Really.
That issue is in the film, and it isn't as pronounced, I think, in the film.
Right.
As it is in the story.
It hadn't occurred to me, you know,
right.
I've seen it so many times.
Right.
But I had never stopped to think about it in that way. So it was really...
Yeah, it's much more, it's there in the film, but it's much more meticulously organized and arranged as a kind of ongoing major thread of the story. Mm-hmm. And in the film it comes up from time to time. You're shown in the film, the screenwriter does a great job of imagining the sorts of things that Paul is up to when he goes out in those evenings. And in the story, you're just left to imagine what some of those things might be. I mean, that the fact that he's behind in the big poker game, that's mentioned in the story. It's just that now these various settings and so forth where these games are going on are shown here, and you get to see some of the things that are only mentioned as happening in the story. I mean, you're told that he's been in a fight over this girlfriend of his who is a Cheyenne Indian woman, and that's why Norman goes to bail him out of jail. Here you're actually shown these altercations and so forth. But I think as I said in my session yesterday, the film is really a fine work of art in its own right, and takes up some of the lesser themes in there and pulls them out and makes them more dominant, particularly the relationship between him and Jesse, because mm-hmm. all of that courtship is missing from the work, because he's already married to her in the actual story, and therefore the film is set 10 years earlier than the story. The story, Paul died in 1938, and this thrusts all of that back to 1927-28, when he's just getting the offer from the University of Chicago, etc. And all of the stuff that you see dramatized there about his boyhood is not represented in the book. What the book does is to mention some of those things about his boyhood in the sort of prologue to part one. But you get much more of the treatment of him and Paul growing up in the film. I think the only thing I'll mention, because I don't really think it's terrible, it's interesting if you're interested in Norman MacLean and in the process by which a genius transforms his or her life into art. And here that you can make this week three moves, the process by which he changed his life into the art of River Runs Through It, the story, and then the process by which the screenwriter transformed that work of art into an altogether different work of art based on it. So you have art imitating art and art imitating life, and it's just a fascinating kind of thing to study, which I could talk about for several weeks here, as you can tell. But I think the crucial and telling detail, which I've shared with some of you, which differs from his actual life to both the book and the film, is that Paul was killed in Chicago, not in Montana.
Really?
And it's relevant because Norman had by that time gone to Chicago, and Paul follows him there on his encouragement that that might be a good place where he can find a kind of big city job on a big city paper, because his beats there, you can tell this a little in the film, are becoming kind of boring and routine to him in Helena. And so basically, the kind of big sky style where you go out to bars and you get into poker games and fighting is not uncommon, but there are certain kind of ground rules, plays out rather differently in Hyde Park or South Chicago. So it's not too long after Paul gets there that he's found beaten up in an alley, and one can only surmise how much that fact haunted Norman. And one can't help but be impressed that in the fiction, both the film and the story, he has Paul say, "I'll never leave Montana." So it's a kind of an interesting, I think, and profoundly interesting thing to think about, the significance of that change in the actual life experience in both the story and in the film. Okay, so I'm going to proceed today on Young Men and Fire pretty much the same way I did with River Runs Through It, which is to first talk about the structure of the book somewhat, then some of its major themes. Before turning to that, I thought I'd read you something I alluded to yesterday at the very end of the discussion of River Runs Through It, when I talked about how widely praised the two books are by the real professionals in those two areas. That is, forest fighters love Young Men in Fire and say he really understands this. And fly fishermen, all the people who are expert in that area, think that he's exactly right about fly fishing. And this is an excerpt, it's the first paragraph of a wonderful article written by a guy named Stephen Pine, who teaches at Arizona State, teaches ecology and environmental history, and himself fought fires for many years. And he has a wonderful essay on Young Men in Fire called The Old Man and the Fire. And here is his opening paragraph. "No book has influenced wildland fire in America as much as Norman MacLean's 1992 meditation, Young Men in Fire. No other book comes close. No text, even Kenneth Davis's classic Forest Fire, Control and Use, no specimen of fiction, including George Stewart's enduring 1948 novel, Fire, none of a growing library of personal memoirs, journalistic inquiries, or lurid romances. The 1994 fire season became one of note and of reform, largely because MacLean's best-selling text had primed the national media to the possible meaning of blow-up fires and scorched crews. MacLean demonstrated that the great void in fire management had been cultural. The field had lost contact with its sustaining culture. Until it found the philosopher-poet, the tragedy at Man Gulch barely transcended the subculture of Northern Rockies fire lore. The truth is, fire history, like fire, takes its character from its context. Man Gulch had to wait for 43 years before its flames connected to the right cultural tinder. Since then, it has become an American icon, its bleached hillside a sacred site, and smoke jumpers, a group whose egos were already on steroids, the most celebrated caste in the fire community. Out of its towering columns of text, the book has cast spot fires across the literary landscape of America. The man who ended his first book, A River Runs Through It, with the line, "I am haunted by waters," ended his life, it seems, haunted by flames. And in a way, that last line is a good transition to the book, ended his life, in a way, haunted by flames. As I told you about River Runs Through It, the remarkable thing there about its composition is that Norman doesn't really begin to write it until he's 70 years old. He begins to conceive of the three stories and to write them that are part of the book that was issued in 1976. When he retires after his 70 years at the University of Chicago in 1973. So that in itself is remarkable. What's even more remarkable to me is that then he turns immediately in 1976 to the research for this book. And he's not really finished with the writing of that book when he dies in 1990. He's still fiddling with it. There's a sense in which he can never satisfy himself that he's getting it right. The research alone is a kind of Herculean task for a man who does most of it in his late 70s and early 80s, not just by pouring through archives and interviewing people, but also by trekking for 4 years in a row into some of the most forbidding and treacherous terrain in the United States, namely Man Gulch itself. So already back in the summer of 1976, he returns to Man Gulch, which the average temperature in Man Gulch when he's there always in July and early August, trying to be there the same time that this tragedy happened, which happened in 1949 on August 5th, always when he goes back there, the temperature there in the gulch averages between 90 and 98. Down at the bottom of the gulch, it's roughly 114. The slopes are at 45 degree angles. It's actually technically a 76% slope, which means that for every 10 feet you go this way, you go 7.6 feet this way. And he's scrambling up the side of those hills in 114 degree heat in 1976, 1977, 1978, and again in 1979, to try to get straight exactly what happened there. And he's 75 years old. So part of the book, now I'm coming to the structure, is simply his story of his determination to find out the truth of what happened. The book has three parts, and we know that those three parts were his parts. Even though the book was unfinished, and even though the editor of U of C Press had to work with his daughter Jean and some other friends to put it together, we do know that he thought of it as having always three parts. The first two, about equally long, each about 140 pages. Part one is basically the story of the Man Gulch fire. Part two is basically the story of finding the story of the Man Gulch fire, or more exactly, his story about his efforts to find out whether there was, in fact, a story to the Man Gulch fire. Okay, that sounds pretty complicated, but I'll repeat it. Part two is the story of his effort to find out whether there was a story. And I'll read you a passage later where this will become clearer. So those are the two main parts. And then there's a third part, a kind of a coda, which is very short, but which is the part in which he tries to follow these men to their final death through an act of compassion and imagination, which he talks about at some length, just how he had to prepare himself to be able to write that very last part. so it has those three parts. The editors at the University of Chicago Press saw fit to add to the book a kind of preamble because they found in his papers a sort of story called Black Ghost. And Black Ghost is really a story about his own, some of his own early firefighting days, and it culminates with his standing in the embers, quite literally, of the Mann Gulch fire in August of 1949. So he was there in its immediate aftermath. And what's curious to me is that if you read the acknowledgments to the book, they tell you that they made the decision to add it to the text as a preamble, not being sure what his intentions were. But oddly, in the book, he himself mentions that very episode, which is narrated in this section, Black Ghost. So it seems to me pretty clear that he intended it to be used in the way that they used it. Otherwise, it's inconceivable to me that they would have put it in there. I'll just read you that little passage that comes on page 215 if you have a book. He says, "By the time I knew only where the crevice and the foreman's fire were in the main story of Mann Gulch, I already knew most of another part of the story. I already knew there would be such a part, and I knew I would search for it when I first saw the fire itself and the black burned ghost of a deer bleeding where its skin had melted. I knew I would write about this the moment I discovered we had not thrown a rifle into the cab of the truck, and so could only hope the deer would die soon. It was at this moment that I knew my story of the Mann Gulch fire would have a part in it asking the question, did any good at all, come of this?" Now, if we're to believe him here, and I don't see any reason why we don't, though it's technically true that he doesn't really begin to write fiction or this very special kind of creative nonfiction until after he retired, the seed for these stories was germinating in him for a long time. As we'll see tomorrow when we talk about his theology, I'll begin by passing out a passage to us all to look at where the same thing happens in River Runs Through It. We have a moment in River Runs Through It where he says, while sitting on the bank of a river, that it was at that moment, and this would have been now back in 1937, that he realized that he would someday write the story of this. So that in both of these major works, you have within them these crucial moments where he decides that someday he will write the story, even though he waits, so far as we can tell, until he's 70 years old to begin writing them, spending 3 years writing River Runs Through It, and of course the rest of his life never quite finishing Young Men in Fire. There's also a passage, since I just mentioned one or read you one here in this book that anticipates its own writing, you mentioned the other one. There are curious references in each of these two books to the other book. For a long time, I wondered why in River Runs Through It, as I mentioned yesterday, it has these four parts, and each of the four parts has at its center a fishing scene. And you would think, or you would wonder, why don't all four of those fishing scenes take place in the favorite fishing hole of the McLean family, the Big Blackfoot? Three of the four do. One of them does not. It takes place in the Elkhorn River. It's part two. And I'll read you what happens at the end of that. Some of you may remember this if you've read the book. They're fishing at the Elkhorn River. He and his brother, a storm is coming up, and here I read, "Let's get a move on," I said. "We hit the trail and started upstream. The black cloud was taking over the canyon completely. The dimensions of the world were compressed to about 900 feet by 900 feet by 900 feet. It must have been something like this in 1949 when the giant fire from Man Gulch, the next gulch up, the Missouri, swept over the divide into the Elkhorn. Man Gulch was where the Forest Service dropped 16 of its crack smoke jumpers, 13 of whom had to be identified later by their dental work. That's the way the storm came down the Elkhorn, about to obliterate. Okay, so in other words, you notice right away when you came in, I'm sure, recognized this as my artist rendition of Man Gulch. And you've been staring carefully at the artistry here. I was afraid you might be distracted, but here's the Missouri River. Here we have Man Gulch. This is the bottom of Man Gulch, the north side and the south side of Man Gulch as it heads sort of in a north easterly direction. It's about 2.5 miles from the Missouri River to the end of the gulch. And right over here is the next gulch where the Elkhorn River is located. And so you have this connection, this kind of evidence, it seems to me, of this story, very clear evidence, because he says it's 900 by 900 by 900, and he means this dimension here, whereas we'll see in a moment the main final tragic action takes place, and he realizes when he's writing this story that that canyon through which the Elkhorn flows, and he and his brother were fishing when the storm came up, had about that kind of same dimension.
Is Man Gulch dry?
Pardon me?
Is Man Gulch dry?
Yes, it's quite dry. In fact, at the time of the fire, Helena recorded 97 degree heat and humidity of 3%. I keep trying to think of whether I would be, at 78 years old, capable of clabbering around there in cheatgrass at that kind of temperature. But he was determined to find out what happened, and he could only find out what happened by going back there. We get similar things echoing back in Young Men in Fire. Two River runs through it, and I thought I'd read you a very interesting passage there. He's wondering about, as he looks around for the evidence, he's wondering why it is that so many records are lost, and why it is that some of the records seem to be doctored as he looks at the fundamental documents that were kept on the Man Gulch fire as to just exactly what happened. And he's wondering why so many people clam up when he tries to talk with them. And this is now a passage I'm going to read you because it points back in ways that you would never understand if you hadn't read River Runs Through It to that book. And now that you've seen the film even, you'll get this. He says, the reasons why parents, relatives, and close friends hoped for silence are naturally very different from the government's. The Forest Service sought silence. The parents were reduced to it, although in sad ways, they too may also have sought it. On the whole, they were not people of means and could not afford to appeal their case to the Supreme Court, even if they had wished, and except for Fall, one of the parents, they must have had small understanding of their own case and therefore an underlying reluctance to pursue it. Most important of all, probably, is the secrecy of the grief and moral bewilderment suffered at the death of one of ourselves who was young, had a special flair, a special daring, a special disregard for death, who seemed both to himself and to us to be apart from death, especially from death, leaving behind no explanation of itself, either as a sequence of events or as a moral occurrence in a what kind of a universe is this anyway? It is the frightened and recessive grief suffered for one whom you hoped neither death nor anything evil would dare touch. Afterwards, you live in fear that something might alter your memory of him and of all things. I should know. So that obviously is pointing back to Paul. And of course, ending this paragraph, I should know, when you read this book, has a special poignancy because after, it's in 1979, when he finally figures out the great mystery that he's been trying to figure out about this escape fire that you'll learn about in a moment. And when he looks back for the last time to Man Gulch, way up here at the end, he says, finally, now we know. And he goes on to say, this is the perhaps saddest but most profound short poem one could write, simply, now we know. And of course, no K-N-O-W, and now at the beginning. And this echoes, I should know, which points back to River Runs Through It. So there are all these very complicated kind of intertextual references. And the more you read these two books, the more these kind of leap out at you, as the whole business about the Elkhorn River leapt out at me about 48 hours ago when I was preparing for this particular presentation. We're always learning, and I think you can say this about MacLean's books, is that you really never do get to the bottom of them, largely because he really never got to the bottom, he'd be the first to say, of what happened there in Man Gulch. Okay, I'm going to give you the major plot of part one through a kind of film. This is part of a Nova special from television called Fire Wars, which is about wildfires in the West. And since this is such a famous fire, they actually did a computer simulation of what took place in that gulch as a part of this. And we'll just watch that, and that'll save me from sort of summarizing what happened.
If there was smoke, then there was fire. If there was fire, then you go and put it out. And the decision on Man Gulch was just as swift as that.
Man Gulch, central Montana. A canyon that empties into the Missouri River, flanked by two steep ridges. On August 5th, 1949, a small fire was sighted on the South Ridge. At the base in Missoula, calls went out for jumpers. It was Eldon Dieter's 19th birthday. He was just sitting down to dinner with his parents when the phone rang. Walt Rumsey and 17-year-old Robert Salee were new jumpers. It was their first day on the job.
Lightning storm came down through the region and started a lot of fires, and they called us in. When I got to Missoula, we actually arrived and jumped the same day.
For many of them, this is their first year of smoke jumping. And there are very few of them that know the crew leader, the boss of this crew, Wagner Wag Dodd. Wag is a very experienced hand. You know, he's been jumping for 8 years and working for the Forest Service for a dozen years at that point.
I think he was a very creative guy with a little touch of the poet. And he covered that up with a silence that was customary among men in those days.
Dodge's creativity and his silence would have profound consequences on this fire. The jumpers landed at the head of the gulch, about a mile in from the river. They're going to get something to eat, they're going to attack the fire, they'll be on it all night. It's kind of a mop-up. Dodge went to check the fire. He didn't like what he saw. This was no mop-up. The fire was burning furiously in an explosive mixture of thick pine.
hadn't gone any more than 100 or 200 yards, something like that, and we met Dodge coming back down, and he said, this thing, reproduction is a death trap. We better get out of here.
Dodge led the crew across the gulch, heading for the safety of the river. The fire was out of their line of sight. They had no way of knowing it had suddenly jumped across to their side of the canyon. Their escape to the river was cut off.
When he crests that hill and looks down below him, he sees that the fire is now burning very vigorously below them, and much worse, right directly at his crew.
Dodge reversed the crew and told them to run. They were now in a race for their lives. Then the fire hit grass, made bone dry by weeks of summer heat, and began closing in. It was only 150 yards away, racing towards them up the brutally steep canyon. The physics of slope and wind and fire were now converging on the crew in a terrifying equation. People move slower uphill. Fire moves faster. Because heat rises, a fire burning on level ground spreads three times as fast when it reaches a 25% slope, and nine times as fast on a 50% slope. Slopes at Mount Gulch are 76%.
Now you see everything is working in its favor. The radiant heat is getting ahead, convective heat is getting there, you're creating a draft which is driving it up. This is a very dangerous place to be, and you're going to have a very hard time outrunning a fire in light fuels that is going to burn upslope.
By the time the fire was right behind us, it sounded like a freight train or a jet airplane. It was a tremendous roar.
The fire only 50 yards away, Dodge realized they'd lost the race.
Wag reaches into his pocket, pulls out some paper matches, and again, without saying anything to the group, lights the grass on fire.
The men who were with him thought that the boss had gone nuts. You know, what's he doing? We've already got enough fire behind us. We don't need another one in front of us.
What he was doing was lighting an escape fire to burn off fuel in front of the main fire and create a safety zone of black.
Dodge's escape fire burns off no more than a 10-by-10-foot square area. He turns to the guys who are momentarily frozen on the hillside and says, up this way, up this way. The crew is really confused about this. They don't know what he means, up this way.
I personally didn't have a clue as to what he was doing. In fact, I thought maybe that he lost it because it didn't make sense to me.
Baffled by Dodge's tactic, most of the crew kept racing across the slope. Salim, Rumsey, and Dieter changed course, running straight up, using Dodge's fire as a guide.
And his fire immediately started burning straight up the ridge, and so I just fell in alongside it and vaulted up the hill.
They palmed up this thing. When they get up here close to the ridge top, they're almost made it to safety, but they encounter this rock wall. Bob Salee and Walt Rumsey turned to the left.
I was praying, and all of a sudden, the smoke lifted a little bit, and here was a big cleft in the rocks. So I jumped in there and waited for Rumsey to come. And Peter disappeared.
Looking down at the burning slope, Bob Salee finally understood true purpose of Wag Dodge's escape fire.
After we got to the top of the ridge, I looked back and I saw him go into his fire. Then I realized he's burning off some ground and he's going to get in there for protection.
Dodge cleared out a place in the ashes very quickly with his hands and lay down. When the fire passed over him, it literally lifted him off the ground and held him off the ground.
30 seconds after passing over Dodge, fire began dropping the runners one by one. One firefighter's watch recorded the moment of his death.
Okay, so there you have the kind of basic story of what happens there in Mann Gulch and the crucial episode that had caused so much controversy for many years thereafter, and that forms one of the central mysteries of the whole book, which I'm going to come to in a minute, because it's a not just one, but a kind of a double mystery. When McLean, though, takes this on, as I said at the very beginning of this presentation, he comes to discover, during the course of his research on it, that it may well be that he was, in a sense, deeply called to write just this book, because it took just the combination of gifts, having been a woodsman, a firefighter, a literary scholar, and now having finished River Runs Through It, that is, he knew how to do research, he knew some great poetry, he knew how to read the woods, he knew how to read rivers, and this was where he grew up, to discover whether or not, not just what happened, which is the historian's task, and which he undertakes brilliantly, but also the deeper question whether this whole story had any meaning to it, whether it had a kind of shape to the story itself that would give these men's death a kind of meaning, because it fit not just into a kind of random act of nature, a kind of cataclysm, or a kind of catastrophe, but that it was itself a story filled with patterns that someone of his training and dedication and gifts could discover. Early in the book, you learn that this is what he's up to, and I'm going to read you that passage right now. It comes on for those of you who have a copy of the book, page 37. He says, "Although young men died like squirrels in Man Gulch, the Man Gulch fire should not end there, smoke drifting away and leaving terror without consolation of explanation and controversy without lasting settlement." Controversy over Dodge's fire. "Probably most catastrophes end that way, without an ending. The dead not even knowing how they died, but still erect, alert in fear and wonder. Those who love them forever questioning this unnecessary death, and the rest of us tiring of this inconsolable catastrophe and turning to the next one. This is a catastrophe that we hope will not end where it began. It might go on and become a story. It will not have to be made up. That is all important to us. But we do have to know in what odd places to look for missing parts of a story about a wildfire, and of course, have to know a story and a wildfire when we see one. So this story is a test of its own belief that in this cockeyed world, there really are shapes and designs if only we have some curiosity, training, and compassion, and take care not to lie or to be sentimental." Okay? So this Herculean task, which takes him all the rest of his life, is not simply to find out what happened, but to look hard enough to find in that actual world certain patterns that give a kind of narrative shape, actually a tragic shape, to this whole thing that frames it in a kind of context in which the deaths of these men have real meaning. And tomorrow, the whole hour we will spend pondering that, both in River Runs Through It and in this, and the sort of theological stakes of looking for this story. Let me say now, in closing, a little bit about the central mystery here. The controversy that still lingered over this catastrophe, even as McLean was undertaking to write about it, had to do with this fire that Wag Dodge sets, because many people felt, and were still feeling at the time he wrote this, that it was his fire, Dodge's fire, not the main fire that killed these young men. That's what all the litigation was about. So he undertook to go back these four summers in part to be able to discover there, after 30 years, exactly not only what happened, but also exactly at what point Dodge set this fire, the precise exact location in Man Gulch where he set it, and precisely the direction in which that fire burned. in order to demonstrate conclusively once and for all that this was not Wag Dodger's doing. Now, that on the one hand, the stakes there seem like they're forensic and legal, but there's a larger issue here that ties into, I would call, the sort of fourth of fifth of five layers of significance. It turns out that he spends a long time doing research to show that this idea that occurs to Wag Dodge at this critical moment was one for which there was no training in the whole program of training firefighters. There was no reference to escape fires. Backfires were not unknown. Backfires being set hoping they'll burn back in the direction of the main fire and exhaust the oxygen so that the two fires will kind of cancel one another out, okay? But this is an escape fire. This is a fire that is constructed simply to create a space, as you saw, in which people could go, if you will, to be saved, okay? And this is the fire that he sets and gets this idea from nobody knows to this day where, under these tremendous conditions of stress. So you have this highly improbable situation of this man getting this miraculous idea, no one knows to this day from where, under extreme conditions of stress, and McLean comes to call that a kind of moment of inspiration, or if you will, divine grace. And you begin to think, well, that's pretty miraculous. And he shows pretty conclusively, I would say more than pretty conclusively, absolutely, that that fire burned straight upslope and it was the other fire that killed the man, just as you saw in the simulation. But of course, that didn't satisfy McLean because he kept saying on the fourth trip, the evidence on the ground all points this way, but the laws of nature just are being defied here. And we have to observe the laws of nature. And what were those laws of nature? Well, you had a fire of gigantic proportions moving in cheatgrass on the north slope. The south slope is all forest. So the huge crown fire here is burning through the trees at about a half a mile to a mile an hour. This is all Great Plains kind of terrain. This is at the exact fulcrum point between mountains, the forests, and the Great Plains, the cheatgrass. Once that fire goes into this grass, it moves, as you saw, at lightning speed because the winds coming off the Missouri and going up gulch are going at 30 or 40 miles an hour. Okay, fine. How does a fire here burn upslope directly in this direction when you got a 30 to 40 hour wind blowing up the gulch? And moreover, how does somebody who gets a brilliant idea manage to light a little gopher match in winds at 40 miles an hour? This would seem to require not only grace to be participating, but also nature itself. Well, even though they don't credit him in this simulation, after years of his research with mathematicians and simulated models in top laboratories, they figured out how it's going to happen. And we'll end the presentation by showing you what they discovered.
Today, crosses mark the spot where each man lost his race. On top of the ridge where Salih and Rumsey went left, Elgin Dieter chose right and found no opening in the rocks. He died less than 6 hours after his interrupted birthday dinner. Dodge, Rumsey, and Salih were the only survivors.
You know, I'm not the kind of a person that can tell you how it feels to look death in the face. You know, it's a terrible thing. You just feel awful.
In their grief and sadness, some of the families claimed it was Dodge's escape fire that killed their sons. The physical evidence suggests his fire could have saved them.
The fact that that escape fire worked for him also saved these trees that are up here in the ridgeline. These are trees that were here in 1949 that owed their existence to the fact that Dodge's fire burned out the fuel around them. When the main fire came up the hillside, it swept around his fire in these trees, and they survived the fire.
The Forest Service investigation cleared Dodge, but did not explain the peculiar behavior of his escape fire. The survivors testified that 40-mile-an-hour winds off the river were driving the main fire sideways along the canyon walls. Yet Dodge's escape fire ran in a totally different direction, up the hill. How could two fires only yards apart behave so differently? It took modern computer modeling to unravel this mystery. As heat from the main fire rose, the updraft sucked cooler air into its base, creating a wind in the opposite direction. With the opposing winds neutralizing each other, Dodge's fire simply followed the contour of the hill, leading Sully and Rumsey up to salvation.
I think Wag did everything that he could to protect us. If there's any mistakes in the whole thing, the mistake was in not training people about backfires.
So in other words, you have this coincidence that it takes Norman McLean 10 years to figure out, of a man getting an incredible inspired idea for which there's no precedent at an interval of time, which they guess is about, I think in the book it says 40 seconds, where these winds would have been canceling each other, where you have total calm. So he gets this inspired idea, and there are only 40 seconds in which he can light that match. Before, of course, not only does the fire catch up, but the winds cease to cancel. So it's a moment of the cooperation, if you will, of grace and nature like you can't imagine. I mean, imagine these sort of statistical probabilities of just one of those two things happening, either that particular moment happening or a person getting that idea, but imagine the two of them happening at just that moment. And so, of course, what's going on at one level of this whole narrative, and tomorrow we'll see the several ones, is this whole question that's always behind this investigation, which is an ancient theological question in Latin, which reads, cur alii non alii, why are some saved and not others, okay? And so you have these men dropped into this self-contained universe. They come into it from the sky. They're born from the sky. They wind up as crosses. In the middle of it, you have some of them saved and not others, and you have this wild zany guy creating a way to salvation, beckoning them to come in, and then you have this whole story about these two guys running up the side of that fire. So I think you can see enough to see that he's found real patterns here, which raise real theological questions, and at just a level above that, he's working on a kind of tragic idiom, because he shows very clearly that at a certain point in this race against fire, and at one level this is simply a race of young men with a fire, which they lose for the most part, he divides that very precisely in terms of things that happened on the ground into five acts, which are kind of the five acts of an inevitable tragedy. And he talks about this whole experience that takes place really in less than 2 hours from the time they're dropped in there around 4:10 p.m. to the time that that watch is stopped, which is right at 6, 5:56 to be exact. And he shows how this need not have happened, but a whole bunch of little tiny screw-ups, tiny little mistakes, which by themselves were meaningless, but taken together, these kind of things accumulated so that by the time they got to this point where they actually see the fire coming over that hogback ridge, because they're heading down this way toward the river and they don't yet see these spot fires. So they can't see the fire coming, but by the time they see it and head this way and drop their equipment And each one of these moments, of these five moments, constitutes each one of the five acts. By the time they see this and move up their side hilling, there's no way, he conclusively shows, they could have run, could have won this race. It was physically impossible for them to have done it. The only way to get saved would be to have heeded this madman and joined him in that fire, or to do what Salih and Rumsey did, which was to follow the outside of that fire as it's burning upslope into this crevice. And they jump into the crevice, and poor Dietert, only 6 hours from his 19th birthday party, turns right and becomes this cross here. So basically, at one level, as we say, it's a race against fire. At another level, it's a Shakespearean tragedy. At still another level, it's a journey to the stations of the cross. And at still another level, it's a sort of profound Calvinist theological explanation of basic questions having to do with the relationship between grace and nature. And I think it's probably right that not only do you have to be a woodsman and a scholar and a storyteller, you have to be a PK to write this particular book. And of course, another one of the dramas of the book is that MacLean is self-conscious enough to build into the book his own discovery as he's writing it, that probably no one else could have written it. And that goes all the way back to the 1949, you know, moment when he's standing in the embers of the actual Mangulf fire. So it's a sort of, there was only one person who could have written this book, and that person did. So it's kind of a fittingness of a deep kind of that produces a kind of conviction in you of truthfulness that you wouldn't probably have if anybody else had done this. I myself think, when I read this, and I've probably read it, I'd say 20 times, it reminds me, I think, the more I read it, of all writers, Melville. He's compared, because of his spare, laconic style, to people like Hemingway, but I think really, just as when you read Moby Dick, you learn more about whales and what it means to hunt them, the details of that whole business and the details of whale anatomy. And here you learn more about forests and firefighting and so forth than you'd ever learn anyplace else. And yet there's this kind of deep underlying Calvinist view of nature and grace that sort of sustains the momentum of this story. But unlike with Melville, MacLean is determined that everything he says can be anchored with a kind of evidence that's literally palpable. When you read that second part and find out what he finds when he goes back on those slopes in that heat, what particular markers he finds, physical evidence of this whole story, you're simply blown away. Anyway, so you're in for a treat when you read this. Tomorrow we'll talk about the theology as it plays itself out in both of those books. Right now we'd better, I'll have one question, then we'll go to worship.
Real quick, you said the other day that River Runs Through It was about the resolution of Paul's death, mm-hmm. and that this book was about the resolution of Jesse's death.
Yes, good.
Okay, can you just...
Good memory, yes. Yes, this book has this leitmotif about Jesse's death. It comes up a couple of times. As he continues to go back to visit the site of Man Gulch, he's always mindful of the fact, and he tells us this, that right behind him is a mountain named after her. The family names it after her and puts her ashes on that mountain. She died of esophageal cancer. And when he talks about it at the very end in the coda, he basically says, he's very interested in what it felt like for those men as they were dying. And the doctors tell him what this felt like, because it seems quite clear that most of them didn't die of the fire, but of a kind of asphyxiation produced by the toxic gases and so forth. And the doctor says to him, it was really, oddly enough, rather like drowning. And those are the same words his wife uses about what it felt like for her as she was dying. So he, in the last paragraph, he actually mentions, he says, as he was undertaking this, this is the way the book ends now. I'll read you the last line. Perhaps it's not odd, at the end of this tragedy, where nothing much was left of the elite who came from the sky, but courage struggling for oxygen, that I have often found myself thinking of my wife on her brave and lonely way to death. So, I think probably, I mean, I can't swear to this, I think one of the hooks in him as he was developing this, I don't know when he met with that doctor, but there's a way in which I think that once he found that point of identification between what it felt like for them and what it felt like to her, I think that he probably then noticed some more of the kind of astonishing coincidences going on there, like the naming of that mountain and her ashes and so forth, and that it was in a way a working through, as that last line very much suggests, his grieving for her in the same way that the first book was much more obviously a way of working through his grieving for Paul. Okay, thanks for being so patient. We better get on to worship.